We all struggle to find the meaning of life, but every human, every person needs a purpose. The ultimate higher calling is inventing things.
Howard Lerman, the co-founder and former CEO of Yext, a data technology startup that he scaled into a multi-billion dollar public company.
I don't hold one-on-one meetings. This is a very contrarian approach. The only way to build a big company is to build a great small company first.
What are the specific mindset and behavior shifts that you had to take on to actually scale the company from a founder to a CEO?
At each stage of the journey, you have to reinvent yourself. My advice to those that are scaling is...
What do you think it is that stops people from finding their purposes?
Fear. You begin to realize that nobody ever remembers the failures. They only remember the things that succeed, and you only need to succeed once.
What have you learned about money and its correlation or its impact on happiness? What is up, guys? Welcome back to the World Class Podcast. Today, I sit down with my good friend and visionary entrepreneur, Howard Lerman. Howard is the co-founder and former CEO of Yext, a data technology startup that he scaled into a multi-billion dollar public company. Howard ran Yext as a public CEO for 22 quarters before returning back to his roots as a startup founder. He started experimenting with a few ideas and finally came up with his next big venture. With the rampant increase in remote work and distributed workforces, Howard saw an opportunity to build the office of the future, a cloud-based virtual office that could transform company culture and productivity. And in this conversation, we dive deep into Howard's mindset, his strategies, and his tactics on how to be a peak performer in business and in life. Without further ado, let's dive in. All right, Howard, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Chris.
I'm very excited for this conversation, my friend. So I actually want to start with one of your quotes that I think really captures the mindset of great entrepreneurs. I just love for you to elaborate on it a bit. In starting a company, founders are pressured to say that they're doing it to change the world. This is because they're expected to fit the pattern recognition of investors that missionary founders yield higher returns than those who start companies for other reasons. Think of the irony of that. I always felt stupid saying that I'm going to change the world because it's almost just grandstanding and does not get to the essence of why I found companies. For me, it's more primal. I see something important that must obviously be done. I think I can do it. I start to do it. Then I am lost to it. It's all I can do.
Yes.
Do you think, how important is it to have the right motives in starting a company? Like, what type of motives tend to be high predictors of success and which tend to fail?
Before we even get into what tends to be high predictors of success or predictive of failure, what I was really trying to get at there is that when I start a company, I can't speak for why other people start companies. Every human being has their own design, has their own purpose, has their own sort of chi of what they're going to get to in their life. For me, I don't start a company because I want to change the world. I start a company because there's something that I know that should be better. And when you look at civilization, I think Steve Jobs, before he died, wrote this kind of like iPad note to himself that's subsequently become famous. And I'll paraphrase it a little bit. It's somewhat like, I depend on my fellow man for the chips I put into my computers, for the vegetables that I eat, for all the different things, for the services that are provided to me. He was really a humanist looking at how dependent we are on other people for our own civilization. And so the ultimate higher calling is in inventing things. And I use the word invent for me because I like to think of myself as an inventor that advance civilization in some way. So when we say we're trying to change the world, that I think is just a phrase that's a catchphrase that's used for venture capitalists that have a pattern recognition that when an entrepreneur is missionary, that they're going to have a higher return on their capital. For me, I don't even think about that at all. For me, I see, X problem should be solved. And not only all day long, we all walk around and we're like looking at things that could be solved. This is a problem. This is a problem. This is a problem. Your brain is constantly firing like with opportunities, but then, occasionally there's a problem that needs to be solved that you uniquely can do. And so that's when I lose myself, when, you know, I'm always looking around and seeing problems. There's imperfections everywhere, right? That is humanity, and that is the world that we live in. But sometimes there's one that just strikes a certain chord within you, where not only do you feel that it's a really important problem to be solved, but it's one that you can do an excellent job executing on, and that you might be the best person in the world to solve that particular problem. And so, Chris, when that happens, then, as I said, I'm lost to it. I literally am obsessed with it. It's all I can think about. It's all I can do. Yes, you see other problems, but you throw yourself into it. Am I doing it to change the world? I'm not sure. It's just that the problem needs to be solved. It's almost like at the id level. The problem needs to be solved. I can do this. We can do this. We have a team, and we're going to just do it. And then the consequence of that might be that it changes the world, but it doesn't start from that as the outcome. It starts with the input built into my system personally of, like, the way to survive is to do this.
So many people have that desire. They see problems. They want to go build something.
Yeah.
They have that sensation of desire inside them, but then they say, I can't do that. I don't have the skill sets. Who am I to solve that, right? Like, someone else will figure that out. I think what stops people from going out and pursuing those things is somewhat self-belief, you know? And so I think when we talk about becoming world-class, we have to deviate from what 99% of people do, which is just observe problems and continue on with their day, right? So I'm just curious for you, where did that begin? Where did you get that first spark of, you know what, I can actually build things, I can learn? Like, where did you get that initial inspiration to set off on that different trajectory where you were actually going to go out and do something about it?
Well, you know, it's really funny. What you're talking about is the independent agency. And for a long time, human civilization really did not possess that. It wasn't really until we began agriculture, and furthermore, until the Enlightenment was really when people began to think like I, and the concept of I became a thing where I as a human can have independent agency to decide to move around and to create, and I can own things, and I'm not just part of this mass that, you know, is controlled by this sort of God or consciousness. And when that began, that was the critical step to essentially the Industrial Revolution and all of the standard of living that we have here today. And so there used to not really be that at all. And yeah, then it became accepted. You wouldn't be like executed or persecuted for having your own independent thoughts. And today it's like okay to do stuff. And so really what you're getting to is now, how can an individual take that first step? And I want to go back to something I said before, which is the matching of problem to person that's solving it is extremely important.
The founder market fit.
Founder market fit. And, you know, when we say founder and when we say market, like all of a sudden that gets into VC linguist, you know, language, and like, oh, the founder, you know, there used to be a thing before founder, which was called like owner or proprietor. Think back to the 1800s. This person owned a shoe store, or they were the bookkeeper, and people had these professions, and they were the people that ran their business and owned a business. And this idea of founders and capital raising and risk taking. And I guess the point is that there's lots of different kinds of businesses out there. And when you think about quote founder market fit, the question is, the first thing you have to look at is, should this business be one in which there's capital, or should it just be the kind of business that's bootstrapped, if you will, the entire way because you're providing a service and getting paid for it? Those are all sort of different questions. The real question that you're getting to is like, what is the unlock where someone will take the leap to solve the problem? And that is just a very personal thing. For me personally, it never even occurred to me growing up to have, and maybe this could be prescriptive for other people that are thinking about it, like kind of if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. For me, I think it was inevitable that I was never going to have a real job. I mean, when I was a kid, I was always kind of off doing different things that I was half Jewish fat kid that grew up in a red state, you know, singing opera. right? And so my mom used to pick me up from baseball practice every day to drive me to opera practice at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. And I can assure you that that was made fun of heartily by the other guys on the baseball team. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that makes you just a little different. You get okay with being different. And you get okay with being teased from every direction. And so then you build this resilience and you really realize that, like, it doesn't matter. Like, you can try stuff. My brother and I were always doing creative types of activities early on. We made an album before, you know, when we were 14 and published it. You can throw stuff out into the world and create this energy, and it doesn't matter how people react because you can just do it again. And you begin to realize that nobody ever remembers the failures. They only remember the things that succeed, and you only need to succeed once in order for your whole life to be set with regard to being able to pursue independent agency.
I love that. And I like how you kind of alchemized the early experiences where you were born to stand out. Most people, when they're kind of looked at as weird or they're an outcast or they're doing different things than the cool people are doing, they look at that as like a negative signal about themselves, right? But I think all great people that I've discovered did stand out in some weird way. They weren't afraid to express themselves, and like they were able to, you mentioned cultivate resilience, right? You learn how to be different and fully accept that. And I think when you can actually accept that, as one of my coaches said, when you can shine light on your darkness, you become limitless. Like when you fully accept yourself, then you realize, well, shit, I've got some unique stuff that I can bring to the world. And you're no longer trying to compare yourself, and you're no longer trapped by other people's opinions. You're like, fuck it, I'm just gonna go for it.
Right. You know, we as humans, we need to, the point of our, you know, there's, we all struggle to find the meaning of life. We all think about the meaning of life is, I've come up with three. And I think the first is actually, I'm going to use the word work, but that's not necessarily the best way to describe it. Work is what gives you purpose. It's what makes you get up every day. And, you know, today for granted, we take being fed and, you know, being warm and all the sort of basic necessities because we built up systems to take care of masses of people at scale that can handle this kind of thing. But every human, every person needs a purpose. And every person needs something to get out of bed for. And that can, by the way, be taking care of a child. It can be taking care of a parent. It can be having a job that, you know, you collect a paycheck in order to support your family. It can be pursuing an entrepreneurial pursuit. It could be writing a book. It could be writing a song. It could be any creative pursuit, artistic pursuit. But that purpose, that single purpose, is what every human deserves to have. And so, you know, when you find one that really calls to you, that's when you begin to kind of leave the drudgery of a routine and get into the like obsession.
Yeah.
And when you're able to get into that obsession, that's when you produce things and throw things out into the world. And whether what you're throwing out is the love from parenting a child or writing a song, you're projecting something as a human. You're using your capacity and your facilities as a person to throw stuff out into the world. And as a consequence of that, when you throw energy out into the world, energy returns to you.
I love where you put that. So we're all born to be creators. We all have this potential inside of us, right? And what do you think it is that stops people? What is the thing that blocks people from pursuing these purposes or finding their purposes?
I think people get stuck and they get scared. And I think it's really important early on in your life, like younger. And if you have kids or you're, you know, in your 20s, like to do some things that are different and to take some risk. And, you know, it's funny, like when I was growing up, I did not grow up wealthy at all. I grew up in a lower middle class family in Virginia. We, you know, there was this routine that you were supposed to do, go to high school, go to college, go into consulting, get a professional job, get your MBA. I mean, my God, that couldn't sound more terrible. And I'm not suggesting that everyone has to, you know, the world needs doctors. The world needs lawyers.
Yeah.
Maybe not anymore. There's enough lawyers already. But the point is like that, you have to be throwing stuff out there. The thing is that when you're younger, before you're married and you have kids, that's the time when you can really take risk. Because once you get married and you have a mortgage and you have kids and you got to take care of them, the risk taking becomes much, much harder.
Yes.
So I think it is extremely important to encourage people to take risk early on. And by the way, feedback is a gift. Bad feedback is a gift. So, you know, we were talking about these failures. Like if you have the courage to get out there and be laughed at or to be screamed at, you know, or to be ridiculed and then get back up and try something else.
Yeah.
The ridicule is a gift. Take it for what it is. It's the truth. And if you try something and people laugh at you or ridicule you, all you have now is information that you can use to inform what you do next.
Yes. So we know you for Yext in Rome, right?
Yeah.
You took Yext public for billions of dollars, ran as a public CEO. Rome, we'll get into that in a little bit. You're building another incredible company that arguably is going to be even much bigger than that. But along the way, you founded close to 20 companies.
I founded a lot of companies. I mean, Confide was one that mobile messaging app that we sold to ISE in 2020. So I've founded a bunch of companies, and Rome will, as you say, Rome is going to be the biggest.
Rome will be the biggest. But you had like Ding Dong and a bunch of other random companies.
Yeah.
But to your point, I think people are so afraid of being seen as failures.
Right.
Right. And you mentioned this, and I think this is such an important point to tap into here. You said that you're completely bewildered by how little people are willing to experiment, mm-hmm. right? Like they need to pick a direction. They have to know it's going to work, which is never the reality. And because they expect that, they don't even get started. So talk to us about the importance of experimentation and how you go about that.
You know, we're constantly experimenting. I'm constantly experimenting to, as I said before, to find signal, right?
And right.
When you get a failure, that's a signal to inform your next action. That's all it is. It is interesting though, how dogmatic people can be. And I don't think it's out of laziness. I really just think that when something works okay, people tend to be okay with it. And they don't feel the need to push it forward and to make it better. And that's when, you know, people, I don't want to use the word complacent, because people are absolutely willing to work hard and put themselves sort of through a rigor of, like, let's take a salesperson who has a script that works. And so they follow that script and they just do it and they make a good living. Are they going to continuously push forward to try different things and to experiment to make the script better? They may or may not do that. And the ones that do, I guarantee you, are the ones that tend to push higher. And probably this is the case for your business, where the folks that are doing interviews and sourcing, that they come up with new techniques that then they share with others. And they're the ones that push things forward. I don't know what stops people from that kind of leap, but I do know that people can get stuck, and I see people really get stuck in a routine. Now, on the flip side of this, it's probably a good thing that not everyone is like me that's constantly willing to experiment, because, you know, that there's a reason McDonald's exists, and you don't necessarily want to have the people that are running individual McDonald's making a different kind of hamburger for every person that shows up.
It's a great point.
So yeah. I think, you know, there are people that need to execute the routines flawlessly,
yeah,
and at the same time have a healthy respect for continuously improving them.
Yeah.
So
I think there's a really key mindset distinction that I can take from that. If you are motivated for a particular goal, like I want to make this much revenue or take my business to this level, if you have an extrinsic goal, the moment you hit it, your desire goes away. Like if I want to be a sales rep and I'm making 100 grand a year, I use my particular scripts, I make 100 grand a year, there's nothing moving me forward. But if you have an intrinsic call to greatness,
right,
of constant self-expansion, of curiosity, of wanting to know how far you can go, the destination's not where you want to get to, it's who you want to become.
Right.
Right. If you have that intrinsic desire, there's no amount of results that will ever satisfy you.
I do think there is an element. It's the Hamilton song, you know, never satisfied. It is difficult to satisfy certain people, and that could be an intrinsic thing that may not be able to be taught. I don't think all people are the same. I think that many people are, which by the way, benefits society.
It does. Yeah.
So, you know, if everyone was to use Myers-Briggs here and go Jungian for a second, I'm an ENTP. Have you taken the test?
ENTJ.
You're ENTJ. That means you like to close things out and have the schedule. I'm a procrastinator, and I'll wait till the last minute.
You would never know that.
Yeah. So
yeah.
I like to leave things open-ended. I like to say I'm not procrastinating, I'm thinking. And then I'll make a last minute decision on something.
Yeah.
But if all the world was ENTPs and ENTJs, it would be a tough place to live. You need other people to kind of, I think as a whole civilization, going back to Steve here for a second, kind of has come together with all of the different roles that almost support each other.
Yeah.
And that's why you need folks that are big schemers, big folks that are risk takers. And then you need people that are hedgers that are like, stop experimenting. Like,
yes.
You don't want people experimenting at SpaceX right before the rocket's about to launch. You don't want your pilot experimenting with the new technique to land the plane. So you don't want Boeing to do much more experimentation on their 737 MAX, which they need to fix.
Yeah.
So this is why a balance in civilization, I think, is important for the preservation of civilization.
100%. And one thing you say that I love is, it's not about winning the game. It's about finding the right game to play.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And you know, I'm curious, if we fast forward a bit in your journey, of all the ideas you could have pursued, how did you land on Yext?
Well, that, I think with regard to finding ideas, sometimes when you have deep domain expertise in an area, that's where the best ideas come from. I get my best ideas, by the way, if you ever need an idea, I would just say read a book. Like, I get so many ideas when I open a book and start reading. And it's weird. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be like in that domain. It's not like, oh, I want to come up with an idea for databases, and so therefore I'm going to read a book on MySQL.
Right.
Like, and come up with an idea. Frankly, I could be reading a book on mythology or ancient history of China and come up with an idea for a database or come up with an idea for something. So I think there's something about making and activating your brain in a certain way that some people maybe come up with their ideas when they're in the shower. For me personally, it happens when you're reading. And I really think that more people should adopt this, because I think it is probably universal and built in, as a built-in archetype to humanity, that when you read, your brain just like causes unfiltered ideas to sort of happen. Picking the right market is really what I was getting to with that quote before, which is that you can make a lot more money. You know, the poorest trader on Wall Street makes a lot more money than the richest cab driver and can work a lot less. And so I think
the right vehicle.
Right. With that, I was basically getting to market selection.
Yeah.
And market selection super matters. With regard to how we came up with Yext, we had deep domain expertise. And so we were messing around with, it's kind of a funny thing, we were selling leads to veterinarians. I know that sounds insane. And the way it worked was, we would take a veterinarian, like a vet, and put their phone number, take a phone number, and then swap their phone number out with a tracked number, and we would charge them per phone call. And we could track the calls because of our number. And by the way, it's really cool. We used to take the phone, this was in 2008. We used to take the phone call, we'd record it, we'd transcribe it, and then we'd use an early version of ML to decide if an appointment was booked, and only charge the vet if an appointment was booked. Now, today, all these things are taken for granted with, you know, all the great advancements in transcription, for example, which was super hard in 2008. Like, you couldn't get accurate transcriptions. Now you can easily get it at cost, fast, cheap, accurate. And now you have to interpret it. But we had a really great model for this that we built for veterinarians. I know it's crazy. And we only charged them per appointment because they didn't want to pay for people just calling for free shit. So what happened was, we were messing around with these phone numbers, and I realized you could swap out a phone number on Google, on their Google listing. And I was like, oh, well, we can just put our own phone number in the vet's phone number instead of the vet's actual phone number and sort of take credit for all the calls, which, it's an evil thing. We didn't do it. But then I realized, oh gosh, that means anybody could basically hijack the veterinarian's listing and put it, like, if I'm a competitor, like, let's get to a more competitive situation here, like a locksmith. So if I'm a locksmith, I could take over my competitive locksmith's Google listing and put my own phone number and just get all of his calls.
Wow.
So I realized that this nefarious thing could happen. And then I was like, there needs to be a solution to this, which is Yext, which lets you, puts you in control of your own information in Google and Alexa, and at the time MapQuest and other mapping services, so that you could lock down your business listings so no one could steal them.
I love it.
And we made this, and it turned out that this was a simple but universally enormous idea.
And it expanded far beyond vets.
Of course.
That was your first use case. But like, wait, there's so many other industries this applies to.
We talked about McDonald's. Every McDonald's location on the planet uses Yext to put their all their store information for their 20,000 stores, their menu data. The the data around locations, what the pickup points and drop off points are for Uber Eats, the pricing information for things in local markets. So now, you know, Yext became this sort of source of truth for all the world's mapping data in all these different places. But it started off with this kind of simple realization that you could use, you could be nefarious and steal someone's listing, and that with the rise of mapping services and particularly knowledge-based AI bots even, which are using structured data to answer questions, that it would be necessary to put a business in control of all the information about itself. And so the old way that that would work was on your website, you'd put all the content about you. Here it is. But the problem with that is it's unstructured. And so you put a bunch of text there, but location data in particular is very, is highly structured. So if you think about a business listing, you have the name, the location, you have the lat long of like where, what the address is, you have the address, you have the phone number, you have pictures, you have, think of like a Yelp listing with all the different facts there. And so you could fill these fields out, which by the way, we were able to sync into Yelp and hold control for a business. But then with the rise of all these AI services, being able to feed them structured data about a business turned out to make answering questions for the business much easier. So that's sort of the whole knowledge engine concept.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant example, because people like, what business do I start in the first place? You had domain expertise, you're playing in one space for a while. Right. And just by proxy of spending a lot of time in a space, you start to notice things. Yeah. You found a big, clear problem, which you were like, this is something that I cannot stand for existing in the world. I've got to solve this thing, right? So you had the motivation to actually go do something about it, right? I think that's a big part of when you start a company is like, what do I not want to tolerate in the world? What do I hate?
Right.
What do, like, that's your enemy now. I've got to go tackle this. So you have a vision. You started selling leads to vets. You start proving out some market here. And then you get to the point where you're like, oh shit, I can't do everything. I have to start building a team around me to actually make this vision into a commercial product and actually build the vision. So talk to me, because you've hired a lot of great people. I know you value recruiting. You've done it multiple times. What did you learn about how to assemble a killer founding team?
Well, I think first off, founding team is the most important thing. And for every company I founded, I've generally founded it with the kind of the same group of people. And what I would say is that for us, it's always been more about the team than the idea. And if you think about it, like, and I don't think that's for everybody, because certain founders have different domain expertise and stuff, but like for us, you know, for some of my co-founders like Tom and Sean and others that I've been working with for a long time, Brian and others, like, we just knew that we were going to make something work. And it didn't exactly matter what it was. It turned out in the case of Yext, we found this sort of discovery, eureka. Yeah. But we, and actually, let me hit on an important point here, which is that when you're starting something new and you have this fear, I like to bucket that as angst. Like, let's go back to Freud or Jung here for a second. So very angsty, and you have anxiety.
Yes.
And there's what's constructive is if you understand the kind of anxiety you were feeling. And so there's two kinds, I think, of anxiety. There's what I call existential angst, which is like, should I exist? Think of the Scream picture, right? That is now a famous emoji, but is, you know, a famous picture that gets to like, should we exist? I exist. And when you're starting a company and you don't know if you have product market fit, you have existential angst.
Will I survive, essentially?
Will I survive? And not even, it's even more primal than that, Chris, because it's not just will I survive, it's do I deserve the right to be here? Does what we do matter? Does anybody care? Will anybody care? That's the first kind of existential angst. The other kind of angst is what I call actionable angst. And this one's more interesting, because after you've hit product market fit and you've answered and satisfied the question of should we exist, the next question is, okay, can we execute on this? And both of those, by the way, have will we survive kind of underpinning them, because you can pick a bad idea and not survive, and you can pick the right idea and execute badly and also still not survive. So actionable angst, there's a great quote from Mark Kelly, the astronaut, you know, when you're up in space, what do you focus on? You focus on what you can control. Mm-hmm. And so you try to think about him up in the capsule there. I mean, there's a lot going on that he has no control over, like when he's up in outer space.
Yeah.
And there could be an asteroid, there could be all kinds of problems, but he's like doing little things within the thing to control stuff, but most of the stuff's happening around him. The stuff happening around him is more the existential angst. The stuff that he can focus on and control is the actionable angst. And so I've always long believed that the antidote to anxiety is action. So when you can get into this actionable angst zone, then that's when you can just begin to kind of cherry pick things and be like, well, I'm nervous about X. Well, guess what? Let's do something about it. Let's take a step. I'm nervous about Y. You think you don't have enough leads? Like, let's go find a few. Okay, that wasn't so hard, right? Yeah. You can do that again. And if you can do something once, you can do it 10 times. And if you can do it 10 times, you can do it 100 times. And, you know, that's kind of always been my playbook. But the one thing I think that's really important is I've always tried to, instead of building a big, I've always endeavored to build big companies, but the only way to build a big company is to build a great small company first. And so I've always tried to build an amazing small company before trying to build a big company, with the ambition that that would happen.
So I love this. So you're building a great small company. You're still the founder. Your hands are in every cookie jar. Eventually, if you want to build that big company, you have to have a reinvention of self, right? You have to completely shift identities,
yes,
mindsets, behaviors, habits. You have to make a big shift. Otherwise, you're the ceiling to the business. It stays small forever. You went from being this inventor, right, this scrappy founder, to a public CEO of a multi-billion dollar company. That's a massive transition. Can you speak to people that might be running small businesses right now that want to make them big businesses? What are the specific mindset and behavior shifts that you had to take on to actually scale the company from a founder to a CEO?
As you correctly point out, at each stage of the journey, you have to reinvent yourself. I will correct one thing you said, which is still the founder. What's interesting is founder is the one job title which is permanent. So you will, when you found a company, even after you die, guess what?
You're still the founder.
You're still the founder.
I love that. You're just adding a new hat. You can't ever take the founder hat off. Add a new hat on.
That's right. You're still
the founder. It's an expansion of self, not necessarily complete reinvention.
It's like the McDonald's movie about Ray Kroc, the founder. Ironically, he was not actually the founder.
He wasn't actually, right. He bought the company.
Then the San Diego brothers, right? Or was it Los Angeles?
One of those
Southern
guys.
California. But you do have to reinvent yourself. And I actually think if you look at people that have done this, I would say that the best in the world at this is Zuck. I mean, my goodness, look at how, when he was, he's going to go down as the GOAT founder and CEO. I mean, 19, starts this company, gets huge. Everything could have, there's been so many opportunities along the way for him to be like, I'm out, or, you know, Congress, he's sitting in front of Congress, Senate hearings. Think of the number of times he's testified to governments, to foreign governments, election interference. Yet he has just persevered. And even still, from his couch in Hawaii, you know, 2 days ago, he throws out this riff of the Vision Pro and totally tears it down versus the Oculus. Now, you can pick which thing you like or not, but one thing I liked was that when you're, you know, he's worth $100 billion or whatever he's worth, Facebook's a $1 trillion company, they're winning in a huge way, Meta, not Facebook. And you know, he is there with detailed product knowledge about exactly how the Apple Vision Pro works versus the Oculus, and is willing to just throw down the gauntlet and put out a video about this. No other CEO, Tim Cook wouldn't do that, right?
You're right. He is also not the founder.
Would Steve Jobs have done that? I don't know.
Maybe. He would have probably done a more elaborate marketing campaign.
He would have done more elaborate.
Something more theatrical.
He would have done something more theatrical.
Yeah.
But I guess my point here is that the professional CEOs don't do that, but the founding CEOs would.
Good distinction. And so you still maintain that product obsession in the details. Like,
I think so. You know, the thing is, the skill set that you need in order to scale things like finance and general administration, those are actually typically kind of, you're able to learn those. So you can hire a great CFO, and that skill set is transferable across companies. So at Yext, I had this guy, Steve Cakebread, who was the CFO of Salesforce before Yext. And he was awesome. And he knew all about how to be the CFO of SaaS companies, and he
unit economics and all that. Yeah,
I mean, unit economics are trivial, but even how to put in compensation systems and how to put it. And by the way, I had an amazing CHRO who was previously the head of HR at Twitter, Skip Shipper, before joining Yext. And so he knew how to put in all the comp systems. He knew how to set up recruiting. He knew how to kind of scale those things. And by the way, the way that that works at company A, if it's in the same sector, generally can be applied to company B. And so you can kind of delegate that sort of thing. And so my advice to those that are scaling is, you know, it's funny, a lot of times, like, I talk to founders that are product focused and they're like, I just need to hire like a product person so I can do this other stuff. And I really think that's totally ass backwards, because first off, when you are a product focused CEO and you hire a number two product person, a number two that's a product person, so that you can focus on scaling the business and HR and finance and all other stuff, you end up hating each other, the two people, because you tried to hire a clone of yourself. But no company needs two shortstops, man. You know, so
great point.
You got to hire a pitcher and a catcher. And you, the good thing about HR and finance and other types of things to scale is that you can hire a pitcher. They're out there. It's harder to find the product sort of visionary thing. Mm-hmm. So I really think, don't, people say delegate. I wouldn't delegate anything where it's your superpower, and I would delegate everything that's not your superpower.
That's fantastic, concise advice. I love that. If we were to fast forward a bit, I want to talk about Roam a bit. Okay. I think this is one of the coolest products in the market right now. Obviously, I've been a user of it for 6-7 months at least now.
I saw your Magic Minutes text earlier today.
Yes, the feature rollouts are incredible. Like the AI, ChatGPT, it's an incredible set of innovations that you're doing. You had already IPO'd a company, right? You're public CEO for, was it 22 quarters, right? Multi-billions. You took a very short period of time off. I don't know if it was a day or a few months. And then you're already tinkering, trying to figure out the next thing. Talk to me about how you, one, why you decided to go build something else after you just had a massive victory, and how you stumbled upon Roam.
You know, it's funny because you said I invented Yext, and then I sort of morphed myself into a public company CEO person, and now I'm back being an inventor again. I know I love to be an inventor.
Yeah.
By the way, I am very willing and capable to become a public company CEO again.
Because it's required, because it's what you must do for the vision.
Correct. Exactly.
But your nature is an inventor and a founder at heart.
100%. And I think Zuck would be too. You know, when you hear him talking about product details in the Oculus, he's not talking about EPS next quarter, you know, due to currency fluctuations is off 0.1%, but we look forward to, you know, shaping demand and blah, blah, blah. It's like sometimes being a public company CEO or CFO is like being a macro economist or something. You know, you're just sort of talking about big picture stuff, ironically, while focused on the short term.
Yeah. Elon says the problem with a lot of public companies is they have too many MBAs as CEOs and not enough product people.
He's completely right. And Zuck, the good thing about Zuck, I mean, he controls Meta, and this is not supposed to be a Zuck love fest, because I think there's other great examples of this.
Yeah.
I mean, Bezos is another great example. I mean, the main word he uses more than anything is invent. And he's customer obsessed, and he's constantly trying to instill into Amazon the relentless focus on customers and invention. And that's a really interesting thing, because there's actually a lot of nuance here. If you're customer obsessed, you want to serve your customers, but you don't necessarily want to listen to their solutions.
Right.
So I always say, listen to your customers' problems, but you've got to come up with your own novel solutions for how to solve them. Customers are great at telling you their problems, and they are not all, and sometimes they're great at telling you a solution, but sometimes there's solutions that you can come up with that they can't see. And I always focus on that, because that's where genius is. And so when you can come up with things that nobody else could see that solves the customer's problem, but might intersect in a different way, that's really cool. And so when Bezos talks about customer obsession and invention, I think that's what he's trying to get at.
That's a brilliant distinction. There's a duality there. It's listening and feeling and empathizing with the customer deeply, but just because you're there doesn't mean you're assuming they have the answer. It's like the Henry Ford example, right?
Faster car.
If he had listened to them, he would have
faster horse.
Would have had faster horses, right? But he listened and he saw the pain point.
Right.
He's obsessed enough and empathetic enough and cares enough about the customer's journey and what they're going through to go deep and say, okay, well, how do we actually solve this? Right. And so that's the mindset you must have been in when you were, how Rome came about.
You know, it's funny because Henry Ford not only was empathetic enough to give people a car instead of a faster horse, he was empathetic enough to only give them a black car. They could pick any color what they wanted as long as it was black. And if he had asked customers, they probably would have said they want white and pink and gray. But what he really understood was that it would probably cost them a lot more to make that, and thereby he had
because of the production prices. Line. Yeah.
And so his empathy was so powerful that he knew that even though a customer said they wanted a pink car, they weren't going to pay for it. And they want a cheap car.
That's brilliant. Brilliant.
So you give them what they really want. Give them what they really want. So for me with Rome, look, this was back to the sort of primal thing of like, I know this problem firsthand of distributed work. I ran a big distributed company. I remember when we started, we had everybody in New York and we had, you know, 50 people, then we had 100 people and everyone's in New York. And I remember around maybe 150 people, we started to hire a couple people outside of New York. And for me, that was really hard because I was always, let's be in the office 12 hours a day, 6 days a week,
grind, every founder's dream.
But we needed a specialist that was a certain type of SaaS specialist that simply the market, as you know from recruiting, did not bear that in New York at the time. And so it became the only solution was to hire someone out of market. And that person was going to be partially remote. They were going to come to New York, whatever. And so when we sort of opened the floodgate there and we were scaling, we basically just had to hire people everywhere. And that doesn't mean this is not supposed to be like a referendum around whether or not a company should be in person or remote. This is just the fact that 100% of successful companies have people everywhere.
Correct. Even if they're not remote, they're going to have multiple offices in different points of the world.
100%. And even if they're not remote, the best salespeople are sitting with customers and the best recruiters are sitting with prospects and customers and the best product managers are talking to customers.
Yep.
The CEOs are on the road. The CFOs are with earnings call, you know, investor conference. So people are all over the place all the time. And so the challenge that I realize that companies need to solve is not the answer to whether people should be allowed to work from home on Fridays or not, but instead, how do you get the whole company working together as if everyone were in the same room? Like my original 50-person vision for EX, where everyone was in the room, how do you get a distributed company, how do you use technology to get a distributed company close enough so that the same dynamic happens? And so for me, you know, stepping back from EX and starting to build Rome was kind of a no-brainer because it was that primal, yes, this is it feeling. And I cannot
explain it. It's that intuition you've cultivated.
I think intuition is very important. I mean, you're an NT, I'm an NT, so I'm very big onto intuition. But it was just a yes. And I had the team and I knew we can do this and we are doing it and we're going to do it.
And you guys have been around for how long now? A year, 2 years?
We are a year and a half in. We have 338 paying customers already. We see 70%, 71% free to paid conversion. And we've invested $0 in sales and basically no marketing except a couple of
dollars. I want to break this down because I'll explain this to our listeners. Like what you've done with Rome, you've gotten past the ARR trajectory a lot of companies would dream of before they've even launched. You're still in beta. You built so much hype. You built a really great product and you were very meticulous about when you opened things up to the public, testing out with certain customers, building community. Like you executed masterfully. It was an executed playbook done so well. Can you share some advice for other founders when they're looking to get their first 100, 200 customers? Like what are some tips here on like how to build community, how to build product, how to build anticipation so that once you actually have the product, you have the distribution and you can actually get it off the ground?
Well, you know, Peter Thiel, your fellow neighbor in Miami, would say that you don't want to build a commodity business, that competition is for losers, and that you want to have a monopoly. And what's funny is monopoly is obviously a charged word, but you can have a small monopoly. And so I think it is way better to dominate a small niche. That's how Facebook famously got started. It was only serving Harvard students. So Microsoft got started with small niche. It was like basic, you know, compiler, which nobody was touching that, but there was a devoted, rabid set of people that needed and wanted that, and you can kind of build from there. So you can't like kind of connect the dots looking forward on that and be like, well, I'm going to identify a small, like it wasn't like Zuckerberg was like sitting around trying to figure out how to dominate a small niche and therefore decided upon Harvard.
Right.
Exactly. It just so happens that, that's what happened. And looking back, you can connect the dots on that.
Yeah.
But this goes back to my point of build a great small business. Build a great small business. And that was our intention at Rome. And by the way, with Rome, our virtual office that transforms company culture and productivity, it is the kind of app that people live in all day, every day. And so our average users are in Rome for about 9 hours a day in our platform. And we have enormous sort of DAU to MAU ratios of like 95% of our daily users are active every month. Monthly users are active every day. And so you have to make the technology and the quality really good. Mm-hmm. And so we meticulously measure meeting feedback scores. We meticulously measure response times, load times, latencies. We've innovated in building computer vision technology that does all the filtering. So these are the kinds of things that people expect when they live in your product every day. And so for us, kind of this slow build has been a way for us to experiment and make sure that we're delivering the highest quality standards to our customers. Because mm-hmm. the first time your Bluetooth headset doesn't work on a video call, you throw it down, you're like, fuck this thing. You know? So we track all that. We see when that happens. And then we kind of investigate what could have happened. And we endeavor to fix that as soon as possible. So I think for us, part of the slower build, and we've grown fairly quickly, but we've also focused on making the product great. And so I think, you know, it's funny, Chris, having started a company, this is my sort of second big platform, let's say.
Yeah.
When we set out to found Rome, and you can actually see this on our website, ro.am/principles of Rome, we set out 10 founding principles. And they almost read as if like a lesson from what I learned from doing things my first time around. And there's a lot of things, no politics at work, for example, is something we did. We also say with our compensation philosophy, we don't try to hire the people that want to be paid the most, like as a sport in itself. I've never seen that work out well. There are definitely people, I mean, you know a lot about negotiating compensation with people you're recruiting. The people, comp is important, and we want our people to make a lot of money. But if you only care about maximizing your compensation, like today, then you should definitely go work for like Fang.
100%.
You know, like, and you can go have your soul sucking life and go sit in one of those places and do nothing that matter. You know, there's stuff absolutely. That matters, but just, you know, like, so we don't want any of those people. We have a very specific kind of person that we'd love to have at our company, and we've gotten good at helping identify that. And, you know, for you, when you work with your clients, like I'm sure that's a key thing. We look for grit, you know, which is Angela Duckworth's wonderful piece around perseverance and all that kind of stuff. And we look for intelligence. And then we want people that are into the idea of this crazy virtual office. And that's where the ideas come from. And so the playbook here is to build a great small business. The other thing we've done is we haven't oversold. Like, we don't have any salespeople. And one of the things at Yext that I think we did early on that I might not do it over again would be a very heavy focus on sales and marketing out of the gate. Sales and marketing investment should really only happen once you have extremely strong product market fit and you need to go up market. And fine, to sell to Wall Street banks and big insurance companies needs person to sit there and
you got 6 to 12 month deal cycles, 8-9 touch points. But for you, you've done this more product led and you've figured out, okay, founders are my people. So I'm gonna go create a community of founders. And you've done these Romania events, these performances. I don't know what you'd call them. You're doing a world tour right now. I was just at your kickoff here
in
Miami.
Awesome. Thank you for doing that.
That was so much fun. But you could just see by sharing.
By the way, we need to get you not just up on stage to talk. We need to bring you with the guitar and sing. Because my God, you have bone-chillingly good voice.
We'll do a Rome song.
Rome song? Rome theme song?
I don't think so.
You joke, but that is the kind of crazy shit that I'd be willing to do.
Well, yeah, you literally had an opera song in the demo.
Of course we did. And by the way, you know, we used to write theme songs and stuff.
Yeah, but this gets to the point of why I think you're a world-class founder. is like, you are not afraid to do things different and like put yourself out there and express yourself. And there's so many boring ass products that you're just so safe in the marketing. It's so stuck. Yeah. You know what I mean? You go out there, you put this brilliant demo together where you have interactive staff running through the halls, you know, like a 24-hour countdown. It's an incredible experience you're creating to life. So talk to me about like the marketing behind it, your ideas, because you have, I think, a unique way of marketing.
Well, I think first off, the founder community comes naturally because like I am a founder and I feel whatever a founder is feeling, I have immediate empathy for because I know exactly what they've been through. And I can sometimes see how things are going to play out. What's really funny about founders is that even when I see how a dilemma is going to play out for them and I tell them how it's going to do it, I can still just watch them go through those motions and make the mistakes.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing, which by the way, I would have done the same thing when people were coaching me early on. So founders are stubborn. And I think that actually is the trait that makes, is a trait that makes a good founder can be their stubbornness and perseverance. But the marketing for Rome is fun. We're just having a blast. I think the product is awesome. We have, you know, the average meeting time is 8 minutes long. And if you think about this ability to end Zoom meetings that are 30 and 60 minute back to back to back, whatever's, which you know a lot about because you sit on those all day long.
Probably 60 to 80 a week.
Well, that's what we want to, you know, help you with regard to having an interview reception rooms and being able to people miss the interview and be able to staff all that stuff. So there's so many opportunities to make this incredible. And it's really exciting. It's kind of a funny thing because we did our offsite a couple weeks ago at Disney World, which is kind of like my 8-year-old daughter was like, Dad, you're going to Disney World without me?
Well, that's like the home, the HQ of invention, like exactly. Of creativity.
You know? If you want to watch a video, you all should watch an amazing video, which is kind of obscure, of Walt Disney talking about Epcot, pitching Epcot. So we've all seen Steve Jobs pitch the iPhone. There exists a video of Walt Disney pitching Epcot. Because it had to be approved by regulators and you know, all this like stuff to get the land. It's 2 months before he dies. So this is in 1967, 1968, somewhere around there. He dies 2 months after the video is made. And every time I watch that thing, it is spine chilling because I know that he inspired Steve Jobs. And so that land of invention that world that this genius created would not exist were it not for him. That the joy that are brought to millions of children around the world that show up and have forget all their fears and forget everything that's scary. And they look at Mickey Mouse or Minnie Mouse or whatever they're doing in this park was created by him, which by the way, makes no sense because it shouldn't have even been a park in the first place. He was an animation cartoon guy. And that's where the whole thing becomes totally insane because you have these movies and then he's like, you know, he made all these great movies and then all of a sudden, he started building trains at his house. I think he got bored. And then he's like, I'm going to make an amusement park. And think about amusement parks that are not Disney. They're all these carnival sort of sketchy things. And Disney brought together in many ways, digital and physical.
Yeah. So you have
that. And by the way, that's part of our vision for Rome. I should note that we're not just building a virtual office that's going to exist on your computer. We want to link real world meetings together. We have solutions for hybrid. There could be partnerships with office and office buildings around. I'm a pro office guy. I work out of an office every day. So part of building the world's distributed office is going to include bringing people together physically as well as digitally.
So interesting. One thing that I think you're known for is a little bit of contrarian productivity hacks. I think you talk about them a lot. You've learned a lot from Yext. You've been applying a lot to Rome from your learnings at Yext. What you've built and the time you've built it at Rome is pretty astounding. And one, you're like, it's because we're building in Rome. We have all the different.
We eat a lot of dog food.
But you also have like small tactical things that with compound interest start to really stack up and you start to build a lot of velocity, momentum.
Yep.
Can you talk about some of the like the key productivity hacks that you think you guys are doing differently that is, you know, accounting for your rapid growth?
So I'll give you three.
Okay.
The first is that I don't hold one-on-one meetings. This is a very contrarian approach. I don't believe in one-on-one meetings. I think one-on-one meetings end up being therapy sessions with people. I believe strongly in, by the way, when I say one-on-one meetings, I will have a meeting if you come to me or vice versa. I talk to people all the time one-on-one. I don't have regularly scheduled one-on-one check-ins with my direct reports. Every VC, many VCs, not every VC, will give you the advice that, oh, you're a founder, in order to scale, here's a tip, set up weekly one-on-one recurring meetings with each of your team members. It is absolutely terrible advice. My advice is the opposite, which is you may have, by the way, it's like, it's such an easy thing to say too. It's like no value add, like, oh, thanks for the great tip, VC. Like, cool. It's like when my dad sends me a newspaper article. Okay. Thanks, Dad.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a cool article. take a look. You know, it's like, so if you have 15 direct reports, all of a sudden 15 hours a week is lost to, you know, hearing people's, you know, problems or whatever, and things be going great, and it's like, well, you know, now that you mention it, I guess I get, you know, it's like
we got 30 minutes left in the call. Let me find some shit to talk about.
It opens the door to like darkness, so there's no reason to do it. Like, it just get out of it.
Does that change ever? Like, you scale and you're at 1,000 employees. Does it change then?
No.
Wow. Still.
You know, particularly for like high level people, they don't need a one on one check in.
So you might do quarterly check-ins just to look at numbers, performance?
Oh, like, no, I check in with people all the time. I just do it ad hoc. I hold an executive call every week. I don't believe it.
The one-on-ones, though, it's a huge bandwidth suck. Just have executive leadership meetings.
The other advice that people say is to, you know, like to not have more than 8 direct reports or something. I think that is hogwash.
Really?
I have like, I mean, at Rome, we have no structure.
I have 11 right now, and I was thinking I need to, you know, I'm a little bit overwhelmed with that. So I'm like, all right, but I have 11 one-on-ones weekly. So I need to get that off my calendar.
I would.
Just freed up 5.5 hours a week right there.
I would just cancel them.
I'll just cancel them, not even tell them.
No, you tell them, hey, I'm not doing one-on-ones. And then call them when you need them and be like, yo, by the way, it's not, hey, you have no access to me.
Right. It's just like we're not going to automatically meet without a specific agenda for no reason. Just because.
If you have something, let's set up a meeting and talk about it.
Yeah.
But I don't need to check in with you each week to kind of just go through whatever.
Just going through the motions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But by the way, if you have something, come to me 3 times a week and let's talk for 6 minutes and like work it out right now.
Right. But it doesn't have to be a 30-minute or a 60-minute Zoom call. You're breaking out of the rigidity of time. You're taking control of your time.
Correct.
Okay. So that's number one.
Yeah. Number two would be, we at Rome ship every week. We have a process where I think a lot of companies that are shipped. So the web really changed how software is shipped because you can deploy a new thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like live. Whereas desktop apps, you have to get people to download. Rome's a desktop app.
Yep.
We do have a web app, but we actually support 5 clients because we have iOS, Android, web, Mac, PC, and you have multiple operating systems within each of those. So it's extremely complicated.
Yep.
So we have a process that we put into place kind of early where we have a weekly, and Microsoft might do a, you know, not a very often release of their stuff. We decided we were going to ship a new version of Rome basically every week. And what we do is we have what we call our alpha and our beta, but the beta, I don't know, it's a terrible, never put engineers in charge of naming. Beta is what all the customers use and alpha is what we use. But what we're basically doing is we use the alpha ourselves for a week and then that one is released to customers. So it kind of lets us,
that's a smart cycle. Okay.
The stuff. So, and we have a few other people on the alpha, but
basically, so fast iteration cycles, that's
super
the key.
Fast ship every week. I think there's a direct relationship between how fast you ship and how successful your company is.
Yep. ClickUp, one of the fastest growing productivity tools in the world. 0 to 4 billion in just over 4 years in valuation. Zeb had the exact same thing. He was shipping multiple features a week sometimes, but every week.
Yeah.
Just short iteration cycles, having a faster pace than the competition.
Which brings me to the third point, and it's highly related, which is that the minute that you stop shipping new stuff to focus on quality, I think it's a little bit like you're an army that stops charging.
You're in defense instead of offense.
Correct.
So stay on the offense.
I think it is fundamentally important to stay on the offense and keep shipping new stuff as opposed to focusing on, you know, making the other stuff better. Yes, you need to make the other stuff good. But the thing is, you just have to find a way to do both.
And that's a great point. Even if you're not a software product and you're running a service business, you have your clients, you're servicing them, but keep forward progression of how do we make this service better?
Yes.
How do we reduce time to value? How do we increase NPS? How do like, but constantly week by week, be iterating forward and saying, how is our service or our product better this week from where it was last week?
Couldn't agree with you more.
Brilliant. I want to talk about a little bit of personal mastery. Those are some good tactics for business. You said a quote, condition yourself with the right daily habits and you'll never need New Year's resolutions. Mm-hmm. Your greatness lies at the intersection of dreaming big and doing small. Mm-hmm. I love that quote. For you personally, because I think your company's greatness is an extension of your personal greatness. What are the habits and routines for you that have served you the most?
Well, I think human beings, we all evolved on the same planet, and the planet rotates around the sun and spins every day. But it was not until we learned how the planet rotates around the sun that we became sort of familiar with the idea of a year. Obviously, there are seasons and stuff like that, and we can sort of measure things. But the daily spin, I think, is the way that people can really... I think everyone should have a great daily routine. And I think that daily routine should involve... I talked about books. I read a lot. And I can see you do too. You can really get to know someone by their shelf, by what's on their shelf. And I can see great books on your shelf. It is obvious what you care about. It is obvious that you care about yourself. It is obvious that you are endeavoring to improve yourself. I see Atomic Habits, Talking to Strangers. I see a Richard Branson book. I know what you are thinking about, and you are angling by studying the masters to be that. I mean, Charlie Munger would say that's the continuous learning machine that differentiates certain people from others. And the key thing in your life is when you learn that you can get smarter at getting smarter, and that your brain is really the best muscle in your body that can be molded and built out. So I, every day in the chaos of the day, try to read. And it is hard. It's hard to... there's 50 things flying at you, 38 unread messages in your phone, screaming kids, whatever. So the discipline that you have to have, and I know you're a very disciplined person because you get up early and do all your kind of stuff. I'm actually, it's interesting when you think of like super disciplined people that like you're an ENTJ, I'm not. So I'm an ENTP. So it's harder for me to be disciplined. And you think of like, oh, a guy that's disciplined like Jocko or whatever, getting up at 3:12 a.m., and doing 1,000 push-ups before anybody else is even whatever. I'm not like an early riser. So you can be disciplined without getting up at 3:12 a.m.
Yeah.
And so what I try to do, the first thing I do when I wake up is to fill my mind with some ideas from a book, and a hard book. A book that's not like a comic book, but it's actually like it wakes up your brain. And so in the same way that people work out and train physically, I try to do the same thing mentally.
I love that. I think if you were to distill the qualities of the greatest entrepreneurs, the greatest individuals that change the world, even though that might not be why you start the company, it's all determined by your rate of learning. It's that simple, right? It's like, what is your rate of learning against the problem or the competition? And we have neuroplasticity. We can learn, develop new neural pathways. And to speak to your point, why I think it's important to travel, it's important to read books of all different sorts, is you start to see patterns. For instance, I started working with ClickUp early days. I got introduced to the idea of a compound startup. Oh wait, you can build multiple things in one thing. Rippling with Parker Conrad is doing the same thing. Yep. You guys are doing it with Rome.
Yep.
And I'm like, well, why can't I do this with the recruiting industry? No one's ever thought of it. No one has ever built a company where you can take a company from seed through IPO with every division covered. And I'm like, this makes sense.
Yep.
Right? But I got that idea from studying ancillary industries. And I think that's the value of reading, whether it's biographies, whether it's technology books, psychology books. You have to put in quality information into your brain, develop new neural pathways, and then your subconscious is almost working automatically to help you see solutions and help you get your dreams. But I think, I don't know what percent it is, but I feel like such a small percent of people like obsessively grow and learn and read.
I'm with you on that. And it's hard. It gets harder as you get older and you have kids and you have families and obligations.
The more successful you get too, right? You're like, well, I already took a company public for a few billion. Like I know enough, right? That's also the ego kicks in. You're like, I'm going to rest on my laurels. I don't need to grow quite as fast.
Right. But I don't read books on how to take companies public. I read books on ancient Greek and teach myself Mandarin and other kinds of things. Like, yeah. Find other things that I suck at to try to just remind myself how bad I suck and how little I know.
Yeah. I love it. Wrapping up here, I want to go into a few personal questions. I'm always curious because I think people are listening. They're like, all right, this guy's been where I want to go. You've had a great run. You have an amazing family. You've rang the IPO bell in New York. Yeah. You know, you've done a lot of cool shit. It's awesome. But I'm curious of the entire span of your life, like what year or period of time have you genuinely felt the most fulfilled?
Well, I think about this a lot, actually, and I hope that I have that year in the future, not in the past. I saw Sam Altman said something about half of your sort of time adjusted for like how you perceive time is over by the time you're 22. I don't actually exactly agree with that because I think your childhood is sort of a distinct phase of your life that can kind of be like that doesn't count as your adult life. And so you kind of have to ignore that when you're looking at this sort of thing. And so let's say your sort of mature life starts when you're 20. And the average lifespan, I don't know, it's like 80 for probably something like that for people.
A little shorter for men,
but maybe once you're 20, it might be 80.
Yeah.
So when you look at the accurate, the tables or whatever. So let's say it's around 80. So I think your life has phases, and I've realized this too. And the people that are the happiest seem to be those that are comfortable with the phases. That know that, hey, college was awesome or high school was awesome. And do you want to go back to college again once you've already had that awesome? You want to do something else. And you know, you have a family and that's a phase. And you become a grandparent and that's a phase. You retire, that's a phase. I think the happiest people, you asked about fulfillment, but I'll answer it with happiness, are the people that understand the different phases of life and are comfortable with the phase that they're in without trying to stretch up or down.
That's beautiful. Like you're not wanting life to be any other way than the way it is. You're embracing, like you're just embracing the moment for what it is. You're like, hey, I signed up for this season. I'm just going to enjoy it to my fullest instead of wishing I was in a different season.
You don't want the butterfly to be wishing it was a caterpillar again. And you don't want the caterpillar to be pining to be a butterfly. It's just all should be there while it is that.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I like that. Now that you've had your big IPO, you're going for another run. I'm curious. You made a fortune for yourself. For people that are aspiring to this, what have you learned about money and its correlation or its impact on happiness?
I think there's nothing that I can offer there that would be smarter than like what, you know, Buffett and Munger say, which is that at a certain level, right? And I don't know what that level is. It's different for different people, but it's not like a big number. It's a very achievable number for most people. Maybe it's 5 million, maybe, I don't know, something like that.
Yeah.
Once you hit that number and you are 10 million, I don't know, like you don't have to worry about basic needs or something like that, then, and obviously that's way more than basic needs for most people, but for, you know, professionals or whatever that hit a certain number, beyond that, the kinds of things that having a bunch of extra money can buy you they're creative works, they're businesses, they're other kinds of things.
It's being able to fund your own company.
Starting your own company, funding your friend's company,
right?
Having, you know, buying a business, buying, you know, I know people that buy a nightclub, like that kind of stuff. So those are things that extra money opens up, but it changes nothing around the way a hamburger tastes. And it changes nothing around the way of how a pump feels after you work out. And it changes nothing around the way of, you know, walking on the beach with your kids and family. And it, you know, once you have comfort, and for every person that number is different, extra money is really just kind of like a way to do other things that don't exponentially increase happiness like that first amount does.
That's beautiful, man. I like that. I want to do a quick game called Mental Models.
Mental Models. Right?
So I think that world-class achievers, it's all about thinking and doing differently, but it's all about how we perceive the world, right? Reality doesn't exist as it exists. It's how we perceive it. And our relationship to certain words and concepts dictates how we feel about them, dictates our behaviors. So I like to get inside your mind. So I'm just going to share five words.
Okay.
I want you to just share 15, 30 seconds. Like, what comes to mind when you hear this word?
Okay.
Okay. First one is founders.
The crazy ones.
I love that. I think that's self-sufficient. Failure.
Signal to inform next action.
Success.
Impossible to achieve, never enough.
Fear.
Necessary for self-preservation.
That's a good,
generally a good thing.
That's good. Not a lot of people think about that. You're like, brain, why are you sabotaging me? It's like, no, it's just doing its job.
Yep.
You don't have to listen
to it.
Well,
I think of it more primarily like there's a lion over there.
Right.
Fear.
Yeah. But then we anticipate, you know, like right. starting the company with the same level of fear.
Right.
Like we're going to die if this thing fails.
You will. It's the same thing.
Yeah. I love it. Underdogs.
The best. I'm an underdog. I've always been an underdog. Not starting a company in Silicon Valley makes you an underdog sometimes. And I've always liked to have that chip on my shoulder.
Yeah.
So I love underdogs. And I know you are too.
Abso-fucking-lutely. Two last questions. What is your definition of a world-class entrepreneur?
I think it's a person who is capable of producing, conceiving of an idea, building that idea out, and building a successful business that is profitable for a very long period of time and probably transcends them being in the business. That's probably what sets apart a world-class entrepreneur from, like, you know, a founder that's grinding it out every day. But if they were hit by a bus, the business would die. That's what I think the business.
When you can build this organism that exponentially grows without you.
Yourself.
Yeah. I love that definition. Before I ask my last question, where can our listeners follow you, engage with you online?
Well, I'm a big believer in having great social handles. So I'm at Howard on Twitter. That's the best way to find me.
Okay.
Rome is at Rome on Twitter. We also have at Rome on Instagram and TikTok. And I'm at Howard Lerman on Instagram, but for that, you might get much more of my daughter singing than witty kinds of things. So at Howard on X.
Okay. Awesome. So world-class, I think for me to be world-class is just to be in constant pursuit of growth, right? It's to never settle, to always be seeking expansion, to be seeking your next adventure, your next level. So even though all you've accomplished with Yext, what you're building with Rome, what does your next level look like?
Well, you know, it's funny because with world class, I think that growth and these attributes that you talked about are important and necessary elements to get there. And the fact that I'm never satisfied means that for Rome is going to be a very big company. We can already see that the early data looks extremely good. And we're having a blast. It's growing. I don't know where this is going to end up, but it's going to be fun. And I look forward to going on this journey with you.
I love it, man. This has been a fantastic interview. I want to just acknowledge you too, because I think the world needs more founders like you. I think you're the most pro-founder founder I've met, like the communities you've built, the beliefs you've instilled in other entrepreneurs like me. And you're really about elevating other founders in your journey. And I think it's so inspiring because I think a lot of people sail off in the sunset, they become exclusive. You know, you're just out here in the weeds with people, just wanting to help other people win. And you talk a lot about the spirit of cooperation and why Miami is so special. And I think you are like the leader of that movement, to be honest with you. I think you've been bringing people together in such an amazing way. And I think you're helping us become the next Silicon Valley. So just want to thank you for everything, man.
Thank you, Chris. You're awesome.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the World Class Podcast. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe across all our platforms. Hit that notification bell so you get updates on our new episodes, and we'll see you next week.